They say up until 50, everybody lied about their age. But over 90, everybody bragged about it. Mm-hmm. I'm 91.
That's Bea Oglesby, and she has every right to brag. Bea wants to learn the names of all 800 residents where she lives, at Lakeview Village, a retirement community in Lenexa. Right now, she's got a solid start with 50 names. Bea shared her goal on Lakeview's Before I Die wall, a project that encourages residents, staffers, and visitors to write down what they would like to accomplish before moving on from this world. It might sound morbid, but people seem to enjoy it. Let's hear what some other folks had to share.
I'm Ken Smith. As I get older, I am 86, I find myself trying to discover something that I did that was very worthwhile, and maybe I did it very well. That would be nice to know before you died, that you did one thing anyway that was good.
Luelle Thomas. Well, I'm working on a book of my life with my daughter, and I didn't get my education until I was much older. I was in my 30s, 34 when I started college, 43 when I graduated, 47 when I got my master's degree, and that's when I got my pilot's license, something I always wanted to do, so at 47 I did it.
I'm Barbara Joyner, and I'm 86. I would like to visit Vienna. I have seen a lot of the world. I lived in India for 6 years, worked in Thailand, worked in Haiti, and I've been to England 6 times, to Europe, to Australia, but I've never been to Vienna.
There's a lot to be said for living a nice long life, time for writing memoirs and seeing the world, including Vienna. But as science and modern medicine make it possible for people to live longer, new questions arise, from the practical to the philosophical. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today's Central Standard here on KCUR is all about the changing human lifespan. We've timed this conversation to coincide with a colloquium on the science of longevity at the Linda Hall Library. Over the course of the hour, we'll talk with leading national researchers on longevity, and later, we'll bring in KCUR's Ellie Moxley to hear how Kansas City is and isn't built for aging populations. Let's start by talking with Jonathan Weiner. He's a professor of medical and scientific journalism at Columbia University, and he's the author of the book Long for This World, The Science of Immortality. It's a look at the scientific search for the fountain of youth. Hi, Jonathan. Welcome to Central Standard.
Hi, Gina.
Your book begins with a chapter called Immortal Longings, all about humanity's yearning to live, if not forever, at least longer than we've generally got. You find it in Shakespeare, in church pews, and in pubs. Can you kind of recap some of that chapter for us?
Yeah, I found it really striking when I was looking into the literature on immortality, how deep it is, how universal it is. In fact, if you look at the very first writing in civilization after civilization, what's the subject that comes up first? It's a story about human beings trying to make themselves immortal. You see it with Adam and Eve in the garden, and you see it in the Epic of Gilgamesh in Babylonia. You see it in ancient Chinese and in ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics. So we're talking about something that is really pretty near universal.
How did you originally become interested in questions about the human lifespan and defying death from a scientific perspective?
I think from a human perspective, first, I was interested from very, very young. I can remember watching rainfall on a puddle on my way home from elementary school and feeling touched by this problem that we're all touched by of mortality and what does it mean. And then years later, when I was writing a book about a pioneering geneticist named Seymour Benzer at Caltech, then in his late 70s, Seymour made an amazing discovery. He found a mutant fruit fly that he called Methuselah, which could live 40 days longer than the average fly.
Did he induce this mutation in the fruit fly, or was the mutation just sort of born into the fruit fly?
He induced it. It's a good question. This goes back to work that was done at the turn of the 20th century in my home institution, Columbia University, by a geneticist, one of the first, named Thomas Hunt Morgan. You induce mutations in these flies, and then you search them for qualities that might be interesting in your research. And Benzer was inducing these mutations with a mutagen called methothionine, something like that, and then just searching through the fly bottles for the flies that lived the longest. And that's how he found his Methuselah.
So learning about this guy and his work is what sort of set you in motion then?
Yeah, because Seymour was one of the great biologists of the 20th century. You had to take him seriously. And if he was starting to take the problem of aging seriously at the level of DNA and starting to hope that we might someday be able to alter human aging, slow it, then that became something on my radar. It was no longer something out of the ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics or the quack medicines. It was a serious problem for science. That's what got me interested.
When you call it a problem, that intrigues me because I don't actually tend to think of just the concept of just the possibility of living longer as immediately occurring to someone as a problem.
Yeah, I should probably avoid that word problem. A problem in science is an interesting question to study. And a problem in human life is something we want to solve. So if scientists are studying aging as a problem, I think they mean two things. They mean, first of all, it's something interesting to try to understand. It's one of the deepest questions, unsolved questions in biology. What is aging? And we don't really know. So in that sense, it's a problem in the sense of a very important and interesting puzzle.
We don't know what aging is?
No, we don't. And that was one of the biggest surprises that I got in looking into this field. It's one of the great unsolved problems. The problem of consciousness. Here now, I'm using problem again.
It's
as
okay.
A
we all
to solve,
understand
right?
it now.
Of course, consciousness could be a problem too sometimes. But why do we have consciousness? We don't know the exact answer, but we've narrowed the zone of the origin to somewhere above your neck, let's say. With aging, we don't know where in the body aging starts or where in the cells of the body it starts, what exactly progresses year by year that we call aging, looking on. And this really is a fascinating challenge to try to understand. If you're one of these biologists who wants to get at the fundamentals of life, of how it works.
You followed this guy, Aubrey de Grey, who's proposing what he calls 500-year humans. Tell me about Aubrey and what exactly he's after.
Well, I have to say it was a big step from the lab of Seymour Benzer to talking with Aubrey de Grey in his favorite pub in Cambridge. Aubrey is not a laboratory scientist. Aubrey is what he likes to call a theoretical biologist. He tries to understand aging from the point of view of a theorist, try to brainstorm almost a Sherlock Holmes of aging. And Aubrey has extremely controversial ideas about aging and an extremely colorful way of presenting them. And all of that attracted me to Aubrey. He's got a beard down to his waist.
Wow.
He looks like a medieval saint. I think he cultivates that appearance almost the way a doctor would wear a white lab coat. I mean, he looks like one of the immortals. And he argues that if we did get at the fundamental cause of aging, and he has ideas about it, then
ideas like what?
Well, he thinks that we might look at aging as a gradual accumulation of byproducts in the body, the way an engine as it runs and runs collects grease and gunk. the body, too, collects all sorts of grease and gunk. Age spots, for instance, that's a kind of sticky gunk called lipofuscin, I think it's called. And if you could get rid of the lipofuscin all through the body's cells, then perhaps you would be fighting something fundamentally changing in our bodies that we call aging. And there are other kinds of junk, too. For instance, amyloid in the brain builds up, and that's clearly associated in some way with Alzheimer's and other neurodegenerative diseases.
So we've got to avoid gunk.
Avoid the gunk. Basically, that's Aubrey's argument, but it gets pretty complex in the practice because there are so many different kinds of gunk, and we're talking about basic byproducts of life itself.
So he thinks that if we figure this out, then what happens?
Yeah, if we figure this out, if we can solve, I think he has a list of seven these days, seven kinds of accumulating gunk to get rid of or to prevent their accumulation. If we could solve that, then we would be living decades and decades longer than we do. And he has a further argument, which is also controversial among scientists who study aging. He argues that if we start living decades and decades longer, that gives science decades and decades longer to come up with solutions to the various problems that the aging bodies accrue. So, cataracts or arthritis or whatever you suffer from in your 80s and your 90s, if you're going to postpone those kinds of infirmities until you're 110, 120, well, maybe by then science will have long since figured out how to prevent them. And so by that reasoning, maybe we could achieve what Aubrey calls escape velocity, and we could simply fly along in perfect health until we made a bad call and stepped off the curb at the wrong time and a bus came along. We could live essentially forever. That's Aubrey's argument.
And so he, though, is not a scientist, right?
No, he started out as a computer scientist, and I think that has a lot to do with his kind of cocky confidence in facing this ancient question of mortality. He doesn't see why we should be daunted by it. We should be able to fix this. That's Aubrey's attitude.
What does the scientific community have to say? I mean, you've also looked into where the scientific community actually is right now on extending the human lifespan and increasing longevity.
That's right. And I don't want to paint Aubrey too much into the, too much as a flake. He has written papers with serious people in the field, and many of his ideas, other than this life for 1,000 years, people do take very seriously. So in the center, say, of the aging field, you have people like one of your other guests on the show right now, Jay Olshansky,
who I will be turning to very shortly.
Yeah. So Jay and others hope for a much more modest but still really, really significant benefit to understanding aging at the biological level. Maybe we could get 7 more healthy years, say, on average, if we really understood what aging is and understood how best to slow it. If we could do that, then we would have enormous benefits in the view of the people campaigning for this. They call it the longevity dividend, all sorts of dividends that might come from giving us another 7 good years.
Well, let's jump in here because this is exactly the time to turn to Jay Olshansky. He's with us from the School of Public Health at the University of Chicago. His session at this weekend's colloquium is actually called the Longevity Dividend. Hi, Jay.
Hi, good morning.
Great. It's great to have you. Thanks for being with us. When you talk about the longevity dividend, I'm intrigued by that phrase. What exactly does it mean?
It basically means the social, economic, and health benefits that would accrue to individuals and populations if we can find a way to slow the biological process of aging for the purpose of extending the period of healthy life. Keep in mind that aging science, ongoing now, for the most part, is not intended to make us live longer. It's intended to make us live healthier longer. And that's what the longevity dividend is all about.
Jay, we're having a little trouble with the phone line, so I'm going to go ahead and let some people take care of that, and we'll get right back to that topic. And and I'm going to turn back now to Jonathan for just a moment, okay? Jonathan, so talk to me more about what that means, the longevity dividend, where our friend Jay was just going with that.
Sure. Well, I can't talk about it with the authority that Jay has. I've just followed this from a distance. But the idea is that if we live longer, if we have another good 7 years, say, then we have seven productive years. We have years in which we can fulfill those lifelong dreams that people were talking about right at the start of the show. And we have seven more years to use the accumulated expertise that that we all have in our fields as we work in them.
But do we have that?
We can do more.
Does extending a person's life really accomplish that, or are we possibly extending the years when we're beyond our ability to do those things?
Well, that's a really good question, and people in the field debate that. What the dream is, the goal here is to give us seven good years, not seven crummy years, and nobody wants more of the kind of bad years that that you see at the very end. But almost everybody wants more of the good years, the years when you can do what you want to do pretty much in your life. When I was writing about this field in my book Long for This World, I was reading an essay by Montaigne, who coined the term "the essay" back just before Shakespeare, and he says in his final essay, "Experience," here I am. I think he said, "I'm 55, so I'm pretty much at the end of my life, and I'm glad I've written these essays." And I was so struck by that because I was sitting there reading. I was 55, finishing a book, and I have every reason to hope, demographically speaking, I have every reason to hope that I have more good years and I hope more books in me.
Well,
so that's a big change, and I think we all welcome it.
Yeah, let's get back to Jay, because Jay Olshansky, our other guest, has just used a word, demographically speaking. That's a word you know a thing or two about, no?
Yeah, just a little. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, you're sounding great.
Yeah, of course. Look, this whole idea of a longevity dividend is really all about extending healthy life, as Jonathan said. No one in the world of aging science is really trying to achieve radical life extension. You get people like Aubrey and others who tend to exaggerate in order to get people to write about them or to appear in newspapers. But for the most part, that's all made up. All those high numbers are simply, you know, drawn out of thin air. But there's a lot of exciting work going on in the field of aging that you're going to hear about at this meeting coming up over the weekend. And those of us involved are extraordinarily excited about what's about to happen.
In 2001, you wrote an article for Scientific American called "If Humans Were Built to Last." And the central question of the article was, why do our bodies fall apart just as we reach what should be the prime of life? You argue that our bodies were not designed to be carrying us around for as long as we are using them and as long as we could someday be using them. Explain that.
Yeah. You know how everybody in the world of science, you know, we have our favorite article. That would happen to be mine. Now, this paper was really all about human body design and why it is that the various components or parts of the human body are limited in terms of their ability to operate. We basically saw the body as a series of pulleys, pumps, levers, and hinges. And we were suggesting that, for the most part, and I use the word designed with quotes because there isn't a designer, but we were designed for short-term use, and we're essentially using our bodies well beyond the what I refer to as the biological warranty period. So when we extended life during the 20th century, we pushed out the envelope of survival into the post-reproductive region of the lifespan for most people, we had an opportunity to see heart disease, cancer, stroke, Alzheimer's, and sensory impairments, and a whole suite of other problems begin to appear. So most of the diseases and disorders that we see in our modern world are not our fault. It's a consequence of living long enough to experience them. And we have to realize that we're not changing our body design anytime soon. We have to live within those limitations. And that's the reason why our duration of life is limited, even though there may not be, there certainly is not, any sort of genetic program designed to take us out.
Just as an intellectual exercise, I think it is worthwhile to explore how the human body would be different if it were, quote unquote, designed to keep on carrying us around for like 100 years or more. There's an image with the article that you wrote, and it shows bigger ears, a curved neck, a forward tilting upper torso, shorter limbs, and amazingly, a reversed knee joint. Can you explain the logic behind just a couple of those?
Yeah, well, actually, my favorite one, which you didn't mention, is the problem with the prostate.
Well, right.
now, my father was a plumber, and if you were to ask my father about the design of the prostate, why would anyone design a body that transferred liquid from point A to point B through a place that enclosed with the passage of time? So it's sort of a classic example of bad body design. It's the same thing with the crossing of the food and the air passageway in the back of the throat, and the loss of senses, our hearing, our sight, with the passage of time. So these are all, you know, all of these body parts really indicate that they weren't intended for long-term use. The knees are sort of a classic example. It's a hinge. And, you know, even if you're not running, many people still have problems with their knees and their lower backs as they grow older. Now, the reverse knee joint, I'll be honest, was my idea. And it was designed not to illustrate that the reverse knee joint would actually be better than the one that we have, but it was really a way to illustrate that the design that we have, which we're not going to change, wasn't intended for long-term use. Now, exactly how you alter the knee joint is a way to improve functionality. I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon.
We'll get back.
We just need to, yeah.
We'll get right back to this discussion about how long people were meant to live, built to live, and how long we may someday actually live on KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. And we're back. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're talking about longevity and humanity's never-ending quest for a fountain of youth. We've been exploring the topic through the lens of science with science writer Jonathan Weiner and University of Chicago researcher Jay Olshansky. Hi again, Jonathan.
Hi, how are you?
Good. And hello again, Jay.
Hi.
So before the break, we were talking to Jay about how long people were physically built to live and whether we consider that kind of like a warranty time span as a species. But Jay, what about as individuals?
Well, as individuals, there's great, great heterogeneity. So some people, no matter how hard they try, no matter how healthy they live, are destined to die in their 30s, 40s, and 50s. People with certain genetic disorders, for example, Huntington's disease, there's not much you can do about it. Then you've got individuals who make it out to extreme old age, like Jeanne Calmon, the world record holder for longevity, made it to 122, and she smoked for 100 years. So there is great, great heterogeneity. There's only part of that longevity you can influence through lifestyle. The vast majority of it is influenced by genetics.
Is there a way to prolong an individual human life, barring some kind of genetic disorder?
Well, look, I'll be honest with you, and I've said this many times at scientific conferences, the only control we have over our duration of life is to shorten it. We exercise that control all the time by adopting unhealthy lifestyles. So when you fix everything, when you adopt whatever that perfect lifestyle might be, you're allowing your body to live out to its genetic potential. I don't really see much chance to go much beyond that. Now, having said that, medical technology can manufacture survival time for some people. For example, people with end-stage renal disease can go on dialysis and can actually live decades longer. And now we're replacing some organs, some specific body parts that would kill some people at younger ages. So we're getting better and better at manufacturing survival time.
But don't
expect a lot.
What do you think should be the focus of conversations around longevity or of large-scale efforts to extend human lives?
Well, one thing and one thing only, and I can't be more crystal clear about this. We should only be trying to extend the period of healthy life. If somehow we succeeded in extending duration of life without extending health, it would be a disaster. It's the last thing we want to see as a population. It's the last thing we want to see as individuals. Nobody wants to be more frail for a longer time period. Everybody wants to be healthier longer, and that should be the only thing we should be pursuing and, in my opinion, talking about.
Jonathan Weiner, author of Long for This World, The Strange Science of Immortality. I'm thinking about your friend, and I guess I use that word kind of loosely, Aubrey de Grey, the guy you studied who wants to see humans living 500 or 1,000 years. What would he say about Jay's idea that we should only be trying to extend healthy life?
I've heard Aubrey rant about that. And I'm looking forward, Jay, to meeting you in Kansas City this week and talking more about this. What Aubrey argues is that the two are entangled, that if you add healthy years to our lives, you're inevitably going to stretch out the unhealthy period also. To me, that does make some intuitive sense. That sounds like common sense. It sounds like what we've already experienced as we've added healthy years to our lives over the last 100 years, say.
As we've gone from 55 is when you're finishing up your life because you're Montaigne writing essays a long time ago to, like, nowadays you're 55 and you've got probably a whole phase of your career left, not to mention some sunset years.
Exactly. And the sunset years tend to drag on, unfortunately, as, you know, we all know people who are in that unfortunate position, and none of us wants to arrive at it. It's a great goal to focus on healthy life extension and to search for it. And I think all of us have to be for that. But I'm not sure how you avoid then giving us the bad trailing off years also.
Jay, what do you say to that?
Well, we'll discuss that at length on Saturday. But, you know, Aubrey's a friend of mine. He's actually a fairly close personal friend, and we have fun disagreeing. But the one thing we completely agree on is this issue. And that is health extension. That's the only thing he is pursuing. That's the only thing we are pursuing with the longevity dividend. So we are all actually saying the exact same thing. You're gonna hear very little disagreement on that particular issue. Where Aubrey differs is what the consequences will be when we succeed. He tends to focus in on life expectancy and shouldn't. He tends to focus in on this concept of escape velocity, which in my view is complete nonsense. Of, you know, suggesting that the longer we live, you know, we're approaching immortality. I think it's one of the more ridiculous concepts I've ever heard in demography. But, you know, I think it makes for great press. It makes for, you know, great stories, good science fiction. But in terms of reality, it's way out there.
But, Jay, can I jump in and ask about this idea of how you extend years generally and yet can sort of ensure that you're only extending the healthy ones? I mean, isn't that kind of a grab bag?
You've got it backwards. So the idea is not to extend life and then worry about what happens to health. The idea is to extend health. and worry about life. So I'm pretty sure.
So by extending health, you may extend life, and yeah. that's the only way to responsibly extend life. Is that kind of the argument there?
Yeah, I mean, I assume you understand the dilemma here. In our modern world today, in long-lived populations like in the U.S., we have institutes that are devoted to specific diseases like heart disease, cancer, stroke, and Alzheimer's. But none of these diseases really operate independent of each other, even though they're being treated that way. And the fear that many of us have in public health today is that going after one disease at a time may, in fact, make us more frail and disabled as we push out the envelope of survival, one disease at a time, which is precisely why the focus is now on aging science. So, you know, Aubrey may be right. I mean, I don't know if it's going to be a seven deadlies that he's going after, or some other researchers, going after parabiosis or the use of certain compounds that have the potential to modulate aging. No one really knows which intervention is going to work. But when it does, it'll have a profound influence on health and quality of life. And keep in mind, a minor slowdown in the rate of aging, even by just a couple of years, has a compound effect on multiple fatal and disabling diseases. So it would make a cure for cancer seem small by comparison if you just achieved a minor deceleration in aging.
So what is the alternative to thinking about diseases one disease at a time? I mean, I hear you saying aging science is the alternative, but can you kind of define that with some clarity?
Well, you attack them all at once. So let me give you an example. We have people among us now, centenarians who live past 100 and super centenarians who live past 110, got out there to these older ages, in many cases healthy, because they are probably aging at a slower rate, which means 1 year of clock time for them is matched by something less than 1 year of biological time. There's clearly something in them genetically that is protecting them, that is allowing them to age at a slower pace. So some researchers, for example, Nir Barzilai at Albert Einstein and Tom Perls at Boston University, are trying to discover what genes and proteins that are associated with those genes are being produced by these individuals. And I'm oversimplifying a little bit, but to confer that advantage to the rest of the population so the rest of us can age at a slower pace, or maybe even find a compound hypothetically resveratrol or some other compound that researchers are studying that have the potential to have a multiple effect on numerous diseases simultaneously. So some sort of intervention that slows the rate of heart disease, cancer, stroke, Alzheimer's, osteoporosis, and so on.
Sounds good.
Would be a decelerator. Yeah, that's what you want. You want something that influences all of them at once as opposed to one at a time.
Jay, I want to talk to you just a little bit about some of the other ethical tangles that arise when you have conversations like this. I mean, I think about things like population issues, people living longer, but more generations walking this planet at the same time. Very cool if you want to know your great-great-great-great-grandparents. Still pretty crowded.
Believe it or not, it's largely a non-issue, and I've published on this extensively. So think of it this way, and this is where my training as a demographer comes in handy. If you go back to the middle of the 20th century, the growth rate of the population was about 3%, somewhere between 3 and 4%. And the population doubles about every 70 years at a 1% growth rate. And it's just simply defined as the difference between births and deaths. Now, today, the difference between births and deaths, the growth rate is less than 1%. If we became immortal, and I'm talking about Aubrey's immortality, where no one dies, everyone lives forever, then the growth rate becomes defined by the birth rate. The birth rate is just about 1%, which means if under the extreme condition of immortality, the growth rate of humanity today would actually be a tiny fraction of what it was in the middle part of the 20th century. So it actually would not create nearly the kind of population problem that you imagine. Now, again, a lot would depend on the time frame that we're talking about. And then the other thing to keep in mind is that by slowing aging, we are producing a larger, healthier population. Now, in general, I can't think of a single bad thing associated with making us live healthier longer, perhaps with the exception of the challenge that this would create for age entitlement programs. But keep in mind that we probably would be working longer if we remained healthier longer. So I really don't see much bad that would come from slowing aging.
This is sort of a combined ethical and practical question. You see aging populations now that income disparity affects how people are able to live out those extra years they have. How do you see this playing out in terms of income disparity or other practical issues like that?
All right. So this is a great question. And let me be clear. There is no valuable commodity in existence today, whether it's life itself, income, education, access to health care, money, whatever, there is nothing that is equitably distributed. And I certainly do not expect an intervention that slows the biological aging to be equitably distributed either. This is not a reason to not pursue it. So we've entered a very unusual era with regard to this topic.
Jonathan Weiner, J.L. Shansky, hang on tight. We'll get right back to these guys later in the show. But when we return, KCUR's Ellie Moxley will give us the scoop on how longevity plays out here in Kansas City. I'm Gina Kaufman, and you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. Good morning, mortals. This is KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and my guests this morning are with us from a colloquium on longevity at the Linda Hall Library. They're some of the country's leading voices on the ever-extending human lifespan. Now, let's add KCUR's Ellie Moxley to the mix. She's been reporting on a series called Aging in Place, all about how our city is adapting to people who live longer lives. Hi, Ellie.
Good morning, Gina.
What have you found are some of the biggest questions facing cities when it comes to aging populations? I mean, what makes a city a good place to grow old?
You know, I think right now what cities are kind of grappling with is, the number of seniors, the number of people over 65 as baby boomers hit that, you know, kind of traditional retirement age. They're making up a larger percent of the population. They're going to a city that has more seniors than more young people is going to have slightly different needs in terms of meeting public services than one that is, say, very heavy with, you know, under 18s.
What's an example of one of those differences of needs?
Well, you know, it's, for example, if you have a lot of kids, you're obviously going to be very focused on schools and things like that. But if you have more seniors, you're going to be looking at more maybe health initiatives or programs that target seniors, community centers, community resources, those kinds of things. Now, obviously, a lot of those programs like health and community centers, they're good for people of all ages. But it is kind of figuring out what those people will need, especially in the metro area that is so spread out with transit. That's what everyone tells me is, you know, probably the single biggest issue facing an aging Kansas City is how are people going to move around once they get to the age where they're maybe not comfortable driving anymore?
With a self-driving car, probably.
You know, I mean, I think most people are telling me that really is where we're at. And, you know, I think a lot of us that now it seems like self-driving cars are definitely a reality and not that far away. And I think a lot of us didn't really think that we'd see that so soon.
Is there, though, an infrastructure approach to that issue of transportation and how that affects people as their things like seeing and hearing begin to diminish?
You know, I think it just kind of depends. I think right now a lot of cities, they're asking the questions. They haven't necessarily come up with the answers yet when it comes to meeting the needs of an expanding senior population. There are, you know, transportation services for people that are no longer able to drive themselves around, but are they in all the places they need? Do they take the right number of trips per month that allow you to kind of live and maintain a level of activity and independence? Those are all kinds of things that we're grappling with and trying to figure out. And, you know, in the metro, we have so many different cities and municipalities. A lot of them are working together as a region, but they're also trying to figure it out based on what they already have in their community.
One of the interesting things I think you've identified has to do not with what seniors need from cities, but what seniors contribute to the city. You've reported that today's seniors here in Kansas City are healthier and wealthier than their parents were, but that their spending habits are more aligned with millennials.
Right. I've actually heard this a lot. You know, a walkable community is something that a lot of seniors want, especially if, you know, they're facing the reality, it might be hard for me to get out on my car. So it'd be nice to have a grocery store that's in my neighborhood. They want parks. They want, you know, kind of maybe they're not as interested in going to a neighborhood bar as a millennial, but they want things in
their
neighborhood.
But maybe they are.
Maybe they are. Maybe they would like to hang out with the 20 and 30 somethings and have a glass of wine. But they want something to walk to. They want communities that kind of have this kind of mixed use development. We hear that term a lot, that they want places to walk to. That's really what that means. They want to live and kind of play in the same area.
We heard a little bit just now about the practical issue of income as it relates to questions of aging. What have you found about income and aging in Kansas City so far?
Well, boomers are working longer. The current aging seniors are working longer. They're staying with their jobs longer. They're not retiring because they want to stay engaged. When they do retire, especially people who are in kind of that professional class of baby boomers, they're not looking at, you know, we always hear stories about, you know, seniors staying active, seniors volunteering, seniors giving back. And the current generation of seniors, and I'm talking more people that are maybe over 75, older than 75 at this point, they're volunteering in a lot of traditional ways. Maybe think about Meals on Wheels, or I know that there's a lot of groups that say donate homemade blankets, knit afghans and quilts and those kind of things to patients at the hospital. And
they have those in common with millennials too, knitting.
They probably do, yes. But, you know, those volunteer opportunities are not the kind of volunteer opportunities that this current aging up generation of boomer wants. They want to do volunteer work that mirrors the experiences they had as, say, executives or professionals, or, you know, they want something that's more involved and more engaged rather than just show up, meet the checklist kind of thing. They want to lead projects. They want to take initiative on their own and kind of leave their mark on something.
How are Kansas City and the suburbs? I mean, is there some issue that they're, youth, in your estimation, maybe not thinking ahead too sufficiently? Or do you see these municipalities thinking ahead to the challenges you would predict?
I think municipalities are doing a good job of looking ahead. I think that even if they don't have the answers yet, they're trying to figure it out. I think the bigger issue is none of us wants to think about getting older, and individuals aren't considering that the choices that they make when they're maybe in their 30s or 40s about where to live, where to buy a home, what type of home to buy or build. They're maybe not doing all the things they need to do to make sure that home, that family home where they might raise their kids, is also one that when they become a senior and our health does get more unpredictable and might go more suddenly, is a place where they can age in place or, you know, get older naturally.
J.L. Shansky, what do you think people need to be thinking about to prepare for generations of humans who live longer? Something you found we typically aren't already thinking about.
Well, unfortunately, in the U.S., we are not prepared financially for the longer lives that we're going to be experiencing. Not enough people are saving for retirement. I think we don't quite understand what the consequences will be for health, where we're headed in terms of how we're going to deal with the specific diseases that arise at older ages. So we're not prepared in many ways for the changes that are occurring. And also, I would keep in mind that there's a tendency in our world to essentially force people to disengage from their previous lives as they get older, as if somehow their chronological age is the reason why they should be disengaging. And I think that is a huge mistake that society is making with regard to these older individuals. Many want to remain in the labor force. They want to keep working. They shouldn't be forced out, which has been the case. I had a conversation recently with a judge who was forced out at the age of 70, even though he was probably in the prime of his life. So it's, you know, we're in a very unusual situation now, and, you know, I'm 61, and I actually do not consider myself old, even though when my grandparents were 61, they seemed very old. So there seems to be a big generational difference in our concepts of what's old and what's not, and that's going to have to change as well.
Well, are people looking into how a labor force would have to change to accommodate more people in it? Because with unless you're delaying when people enter the workforce, that seems like a tricky thing to negotiate.
Well, so I've been part of the MacArthur Research Network on an Aging Society, run actually out of Columbia, from Jack Rowe for a while. And the focus of our attention in the last few years has been on this very issue, on finding ways to influence public policy that will allow people to remain in the labor force or encourage people to remain in the labor force. And that could be either in your old job or in job sharing. Or as indicated earlier, people volunteering. There's various ways in which people can remain fully engaged or at least partially engaged in the kinds of lives that they had earlier. Some of it can be earning money, some not, but it's really just remaining engaged in our world continuously as we grow older. And also, you know, continuing to learn. There's no reason why people can't develop new skills as they grow older. It's a common misconception that we grow more rigid and we can't learn new things. People do, in fact, learn new things. I think that came out right at the beginning of your story about people wanting to learn and new things and do new things as they grow older.
Getting pilot's licenses. Really be,
yeah, I mean, age itself should not be a limiting factor. We published a paper not long ago on this very issue that there are people, some people in their 60s, 70s, and 80s who are no different, for the most part, mentally and physically, than people decades younger. They shouldn't be forced to retire.
Jonathan Weiner, author of Long for This World, The Science of Immortality, what are your thoughts? Things that we maybe either aren't typically thinking about or that the population at large isn't discussing in the way that the scientific community you've been covering has been talking about it.
I think about this a lot. Is it better to think that you have only a short time ahead and then sort of focus the mind and focus all your effort on living fully? Or is it better to think that you have all the time in the world and sort of luxuriate in that and build patiently, build new skills, go in new directions? I think there's something good about both, that I think we probably all do a little bit of both.
So the psychological implications of an increased lifespan.
Yes.
You know, over the break, Ellie Moxley and I were just talking about the idea of risk-taking when you perceive that you're going to live forever. Do you think that that there is the idea that if people believed that they were approaching immortality in some way, that we would see people taking more risks, either in positive or negative and possibly dangerous, counteractive ways?
It could work just the other way, couldn't it? I think if you really believed that you had 1,000 years ahead of you, you might become hyper cautious about mountain climbing or surfboarding or skateboarding or anything else, because there would be so much to lose.
What do you think, Jay?
Yeah, so this is an interesting question, and I agree with Jonathan. Look, if we become immortal, if you're talking about 1,000-year lifespan, you might as well be talking about immortality relative to where we are today. So let's just talk about immortality. If you become immortal, then death becomes far more tragic than it is now when it happens.
Because now we see it as inevitable. It's coming anyway.
Yes. I mean, think of it. If you die at 100 when you're immortal, if you get hit by a bus or something, then you've lost, thousands and thousands of years of life. So the tragic of loss becomes much greater the longer we live. So I agree. I think under conditions of exceptional longevity, which I don't take seriously in the world of science, but under those conditions, we probably would hunker down.
Ellie Moxley, you are a fairly young reporter here at KCUR, and I find it interesting that aging is something that captivated you and your attention.
You know, I lost both of my grandmothers right before I had started at KCUR in the couple of years before that. And I think one of the things that I took away from that, and I had been close to all of my grandparents all my life, was the fact that I think it really changed how my parents looked at aging. And my parents are around that 60 age range. Hopefully they won't hurt me for saying that. But it's made me think more seriously about what decisions I need to be making now in my late 20s to be ready to get older.
Our time is up after just 1 hour, which seems suddenly very short when you're talking about thousand-year lives. Jonathan Weiner, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks very much.
Jay Olshansky, it's been a real pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
Jonathan's giving the keynote address at this weekend's Symposium on the Science of Longevity at Linda Hall Library, and Jay will be speaking on the longevity dividend. And last but not least, Ellie Moxley, reporter for KCUR. Thanks for taking the time to check in with Central Standard.
Thanks, Gina.
To listen back to this discussion, go to kcur.org/centralstandard. We'll have it for you there later today. Tomorrow, how an artist's career turned to forensics. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross, with help from Suzanne Hogan and intern Kyle Smith. Thanks to Radio Art, I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date's next.